So, as you're aware, this sutta is to Garnika Moggallana, the accountant, discussion with the Buddha about the gradual training which all of us essentially have to follow. A lot of this is, most of you are familiar with this. Anyone who's been moving in Buddhist circles has got absolute minimum familiarity. We're doing this Sutra 107. Yeah. So that's page 874. So this is the whole business with the gradual training, which is really the reality experience of the path. So, the path is set out very, very clearly, step by step. And, for those people who actually practice the path to see the fullness with the enlightenment factors, supporting foundation principles, you'll actually get the benefit of the efforts that you put forth. So, you move in the right direction, move in a wise, skillful direction, and then you see the results that you are interested in will come to fruition over time. And actually, this path does take quite a bit of work, a number of lifetimes. Even the best of people, usually not under five lifetimes in touch with the Buddhist path. But for anyone who attains to, the Sotapanna stage, the first stage of enlightenment, then you're basically home and hosed. You're in the clear on the home run, and it's impossible for you to fall back from that state. And it's just a matter of time before even if you put your feet up and just took it easy, that the remaining karma that you have to work with, has to expire, within seven lifetimes. So even if you just sat back and did absolutely nothing, it would have to completely come to an end within those seven rebirths, as the Buddha said. So what I'm going to do is, as I go through the sutta, I will stop at maybe every one or two paragraphs, and don't be afraid to come out with your views, opinions, your different ideas. I just don't want to sort of ramble on with my own stuff. If you've got any anything interesting or any point whatsoever which comes up, don't be shy about bringing it forward. So thus have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living in Sawati in the Eastern Park in the palace of Megara's mother. Then the Brahmin Garnika Moggallana went to the Blessed One and exchanged greetings with him. When this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side and said to the Blessed One, Master Gotama, in this palace of Megara's mother, there can be seen gradual training, gradual practice, and gradual progress, that is, down to the last step of the staircase. Among these Brahmins too, there can be seen gradual training, gradual practice, and gradual progress, that is, in study. Among archers too, there can be seen gradual training, that is, in archery. And also among accountants, like us who earn our living by accountancy, there can be seen gradual training, that is, in computation. For when we get an apprentice first, we make him count 1, 2. Say 1 1 2 2s, 3 3s, 4 4s, 5 5s, 6 6s, 7 7s, 8 8s, 9 9s, 10 10s, and we make him count 102. Now it is also possible, Master Gotama, to describe the gradual training, gradual practice, and gradual progress in this Dharma and discipline. And it's just a thought which came up in my mind in relation with the Zen tradition, where they talk about instant enlightenment, and for in the reality experience of people, that the experience of so the attaining to the path, attaining to Dhamma, it arises within, say, like mind moments of consciousness. It's something you can double check in the Abhidharma, the way a person experiences the enlightenment experience through the Abhidharma understanding. But the even though that person may get the say the flash of say for example they go very deep in meditation, they go deep to the or right through to the cessation of a feeling and perception, which is the experience of the nibbana element. So the person goes over the years, they, using the jhanas as a basis, they go back and forth between jhana and investigation, and then the proficiency on both sides, the quality of the samadhi increases, the quality of the insight knowledge increases, until eventually they let go to the point where they're able to go as deep as you possibly can into the mind. Because as you're aware that you're moving through the jhanas, you're actually refining those mental factors down as you move from the first jhana through to the second, third, fourth. You've got your five jhana factors in the beginning, and as you move into deeper and deeper meditation, that you are letting go of factors as you move along. And then in the fourth jhana, you're left with equanimity and one pointedness of mind. So it gives you a very very stable, say, mental and Ajahn Brahmi argued the point, an emotional state, incredibly refined. Some people feel that equanimity was supposedly just like devoid of feeling, but he argued that quite successfully, that it's an incredibly refined emotional state, so like equipoise or balance. And then you move from the fourth jhanas into the Arupa jhanas, and then you move into refinements of perception. So the person moving back and forth between the samadhi, vipassana, and increasing the process of letting go, until eventually they go as deep into the mind as they possibly can. They take the process of letting go to its maximum, and then they enter into the nibbana element in that deep state of meditation. And then arising from that, once the energy from that is basically disperses or comes to an end, they withdraw from that state, and then they have those deep insights which arise from that very deep meditative attainment. But that thing with the instant enlightenment, the amount of work that a person puts forth is quite substantial. So it is possible, Brahman, to describe a gradual training, gradual practice and gradual progress in this Dharma discipline. Just as Brahman, when a clever horse trainer obtains a fine thoroughbred colt, he first makes him get used to wearing the bit and afterwards trains him further. So when the Tathagata obtains a person to be tamed, he first disciplines him thus. Come, Bhikkhu, be virtuous, restrained with the restraint of the Padimokkha, be perfect in conduct and resort, and seeing fear in the slightest fault, train by undertaking the training precepts. So this whole business with the precept system is there's a couple of principles there where the person, they're not only actually minimizing the bad karma they produce, they increase the wholesome karma they produce, especially if they use the precept in an active way. It's not as, for example, the first of the five precepts, where we refrain from not, say, killing living beings. And but you can have instead of the refraining side of the precept, then you have the active side where, say, for example, you would make efforts to sustain and prolong the life of, say, like small creatures, or if you see animals that have been harmed in the wild, or you see an opportunity to protect it could be like wildlife or this type of thing, it's the active energetic component. And the quality of the good karma actually increases because you're taking the precept to its maximum range as far as like wholesomeness. And with the also with the precepts as well, the other principles involved is this business of seeing fear in the slightest fault with the infraction, you know, actually committing infractions with the precept system, because anybody who's kept the precepts for absolute minimum, like a couple of years, they feel, because of the skill in actually keeping the precept, you know, because you've got to be mindful, you've got to watch yourself quite closely, and these sharpen your awareness, they make you careful in how you actually live your life, the way you speak, the way you use your body, the way you conduct business, and whatnot. So that sense of, say, tied in with this fear, tied in with hiriyotapasya, like fear and shame. The fear, the process of fear actually, which is wholesome fear, arises before the point you actually, when you're approaching a point of, say, committing some infraction with whatever precept system that you're observing. So you have this underlying awareness, you're moving in the wrong direction, and you can feel that. You know, you know that what you're doing is not correct, it's not wholesome, and there's a degree of, what's the right word? There's effects which will take place, which will, what's the right word? Which will basically work against you, which will not be in your benefit, will be to your disadvantage. And so you get the warning signs. If you're a person who's got a reasonable level of development, you feel the warning signs as you're moving up to that point of say, committing or breaking a precept, committing an infraction or an offence within, say, the monk's rules. And if the person hasn't got enough nouns where they can see it as they're moving into this kind of, moving in this direction, then possibly after they break a precept, commit an offence, and then they realise that they've actually done something wrong. But both the fear before and the shame after an infraction, that it's teaching you. It's making you aware of how your mind works, how karma works. Something which is, you know, is beneficial to human beings, because, you know, as the Buddha said, you know, that those principles, fear and shame, being the two great guardians of the world. And if you didn't have that, if you didn't have any kind of moral basis, you know, within the social community structure, I mean, just all hell would break loose, and you know, there would be no law and order, and people would virtually sink down to the level of the animal realm. There would be, you know, there would be no sort of boundaries with the things that people do. So point four, when Brahman, the bhikkhu, the lay disciple, is virtuous and seeing fear in the slightest fault, trains by undertaking the training precepts, then the Tathagata disciplines him or her further. Come, bhikkhu, guard the doors of your sense faculties. On seeing a form with the eye, do not grasp at its signs and features. So what was meant there with, say, grasping at its signs and features? So for example, for any of us who, say, like, I've got an eye for, say, like sports cars, you know, there are certain sort of qualities and attributes that you see in, say, material possessions, that you see in other people, and they may be, they could be like a universal type of characteristic shared by, you know, the wide, different, you know, wide range of human beings, or they could be specific things, you know, within your own personality structure. We all have our likes and dislikes, and, you know, there are certain things which draw and attract people, and some, you know, a particular aspect may not, you know, do anything for another person whatsoever. You know, it might be quite neutral. So, on seeing a form, yeah, with the eye, do not grasp at its signs and features, since if you're to leave the eye faculty unguarded, even on wholesome states of covetousness, so like possessiveness, and grief, might invade you. Practice the way of its restraint. Guard the eye faculty. Undertake the restraint of the eye faculty on hearing a sound with the ear, on smelling an odor with the nose, on tasting a flavor with the tongue, on touching a tangible with the body, on cognizing a mind object with the mind. Do not grasp at its signs and features, since if you were to leave the mind faculty unguarded, evil unwholesome states might invade you. Practice the way of its restraint. Guard the mind faculty. Undertake the restraint of the mind faculty. So naturally, like living in the world, it's because the level of sensuality stimulation is very high. To practice, to try to practice advanced sense restraint in everyday society would be incredibly difficult. Because you know you have to have to engage people. You have to get involved in business. You have to get involved in all sorts of different activities. But something that people can do is whatever they have to do in life, that they just recollect one's personal karma. And so regardless of the situation, if you just imagine within your mind, you've got a particular connection with a certain person, or you do business in a certain way, or when you're doing taxes and whatnot, that kind of blanket mind state makes you aware of the way you actually move in your life and the possible repercussions, because that principle with all human beings, you know, there's that karmic cause and effect principle. You know, if we do good, good comes back. You know, we do something bad, the bad effects from that akusala karma will have to return and meet you at some point in the future. If the conditions aren't available right now, even to say reach you within, if a person went in the wrong direction or ripped somebody off, and the conditions weren't available for the bad karma to bounce back on them within, say, a week or 2 weeks. I mean, you know, even like 12 months later, you know, a scenario or an event will come up, and then that person will get sort of bopped on the head with this bad karma that they had previously, and that karma can go back into like past lives, you know, even like 5-10 lifetimes past, you know, in the distant past, that I've heard some examples. So all those memory traces, those karmic traces, are there on a deeper level in the mind. The mind's just like a vast storehouse. Every single move you make, you know, as you look at the mind, the process of the mind, mind moments, and the process of the five khandhas with the body, feeling, perception, thinking process, and then consciousness rising and falling. That process is like just recorded in your mind continually from moment to moment. So as you move from just like business, you know, with your present moment experience, you're generating, say, either good, bad, or neutral karma. You know, because we're all of, you know, with the underlying defilements with that we have in the mind. You know, they are like a basis for the karma to take place. They're actually linked. You know, the karma is actually linked with those underlying forces and energies, which will lead people in particular directions. Yeah, Hugh.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and plus you get the ease, you get the peace of mind, the natural happiness which comes from good morality. People outside Buddhist circles may not necessarily understand this principle, but anyone who keeps good sila, they have that, a natural degree of joy and happiness, at least to a small degree, less worries, concerns, and they don't create causes which actually generate problems and difficulties within their personality. People who really, really, what's the right words, sort of play around and get up to no good in, say, general society, no matter how much, you know, how jolly and how much they smile, underneath all that, there's a sense of like unease and fear and worry, and because nobody gets away with anything, as far as the this process, this karmic process, everyone has to pay the price if they move in that direction. It's just a matter of time when it comes back. And actually, that that good morality that makes the path much more clear for the development of meditation and insight, because the people, people can be quite intelligent, can be quite sneaky and shifty, but you can separate intelligence from wisdom, in the sense that wisdom, intelligence, it focuses on the ability to think, remember, discriminate, to analyze and whatnot. But wisdom goes much deeper than just like the thinking process, the ability to use and manipulate thought. The wisdom has a very like a well-rounded feel to it. It's wisdom is, it understands things from not just one or two angles, but maybe half a dozen or a dozen different angles. It a particular subject or maybe a person, it understands the person within, say, like their full experience, not just from one particular perspective. And the wisdom is that which is aware of these things. It's aware of morality, how morality works, the benefits, and it understands the nature. Wisdom understands the nature of the mind. Intelligence is more like a surface principle, but the wisdom goes much deeper. So point five. When Brahman, the bhikkhu or the lay disciple, guards the doors of his sense faculties, then the Tathagata disciplines them further. Come, bhikkhu, be moderate in eating, reflecting wisely. You should take food neither for amusement nor for intoxication, nor for the sake of physical beauty and attractiveness, but only for the endurance and continuation of this body, for ending discomfort and for assisting the holy life, considering thus I shall terminate old feelings without arousing new feelings, and I shall be healthy and blameless and live in comfort. So as most of you are aware, that for example, in Asia, it's very common for the forest monks to just have one meal a day, and because it helps keep the body light, keep the mind light, you've got less susceptibility to sloth and torpor, drowsiness, which really robs people of their energy. Because once you start eating like two big meals, three big meals a day, you get lethargic, and you've got to sleep more. Even mentally, you haven't got the same kind of energy reserves. You tire more easily. A classic example Ajahn Chah came up with was this principle of the dogs that live on the farms, say in the outlying communities. Say for example, in the early days in Isan, you would have just a pet dog around the farm, and if the dog was just living on scraps, was living with a poor family, just living on scraps from day to day, the dog was quite lean and quite light in body, but the one thing he noticed was the creature was much more alert, even though it may have been possibly hungry, maybe even slightly hungry even half the time on a day-to-day basis. it was both mentally and physically much sharper than a creature that was basically fed maybe several times a day. You know, the creature that was just like sort of fed, you know, like minimum, just had like certain minimum intake, had greater energy reserves and alertness. And plus two with the, especially with the food intake, and it's been proven scientifically that even within the animal kingdom, if they, and naturally you see in the human realm, that the more calories people consume, the more rich the diet, the disease process tends to accelerate. It comes in earlier in the lifespan, and it accelerates. And my brother had a friend, had an associate, and this guy just lived on junk food from age 13, 14, Macca's, Kentucky, and all the rest of it. And that's all he ate, and he basically had this massive cardiac arrest at 27 years of age, and it killed him, you know. And you see these days, you know, this kind of degenerative disease processes easily in the 50s, 60s, you know, people are dying. They lose, you know, they end their life early. And, you know, if you look after yourself, if you minimize the intake and you eat the correct foods, you know, at 70 years of age, you shouldn't see anything wrong with you whatsoever. Even at 80, you shouldn't have any complaints which will actually, dramatically affect the quality of your life. But it's a bit harder to work with, because, especially with advertising, with the sense stimulation, with the fast food outlets, you know, they're encouraging people to consume more and more. So point six. When Brahman, the bhikkhu, or say lay disciple, is moderate in eating, then the Tathagata disciplines them further. Come bhikkhu, be devoted to wakefulness during the day while walking back and forth and sitting. Purify your mind of obstructed states in the first watch of the night while walking back and forth and sitting. Purify your mind of obstructive states in the middle watch of the night. You should lie down on the right side of lion's pose with one foot overlapping the other, mindful and fully aware, after noting in your mind the time for rising. After rising in the third watch of the night, while walking back and forth and sitting, purify your mind of obstructive states. So that was a classic which came up with Achan Dun's, the younger Achan Dun from Chonburi province. He's like, I think he's going to be late 40s. But he put a lot of effort forth, an incredible amount of effort in his practice. He would never sleep more than 4 hours a night, and you know, he just ate the bare minimum. He was he's a smaller man, but quite slim, and he just restricted his intake to the minimum. And I think he was doing about absolute minimum, like, this is just a normal day is like 12 to 14 hours, say, minimum of practice, walking and sitting. And but he also had good meditation quite early, very good parami, like Longpo Plien and Longpo Biek and a number of others. They already showed the signs of very good meditation within the first 5 years. And what he would do is, after the meal, he would never nap unless he was really sick. You know, he'd go back to his hut, and then he would walk, and he would walk for probably nothing less than, say, absolute minimum, say 2, 3, 4 hours at a stretch. And he would not go up into his kuti until the sun went down. And then he would go back to his kuti, and then he would do chanting. He would chant suttas, and probably have a cup of tea, black tea, and then he would sit meditation. And his usual repertoire, he would never go to bed before 11 a.m., and then he would be up at 3, And even like Kachin Chah said, you know, for the meditators, you know, he felt that people could get it down to 4 hours, but it's not. I wouldn't say that's I wouldn't say that's a realistic type of expectation. If you've got very good meditation, you can do that quite easily. Even Longpo Pliyan, I mean, when he was really putting in a lot of effort, I mean, he was only physically sleeping 1 hour every 24-hour cycle, and he would just rest his mind and his body to a degree in samadhi. So these things are possible, but you know, you've got that kind of meditation we're talking about. You know, you're doing the jhanas every single day, day after day. You know, if you drop into, say, a fourth jhana, you do that for like, if you did that for 10, absolute minimum, say 10, 15 minutes, I mean, that's like worth like 4 hours sleep for the average person. So it's quite interesting what you can you do when you rest the mind at a very deep level, and you're maximizing the energy which is actually coming from that samadhi state.
This business, purify your mind of obstructive states. So that specifically means the removal of the underlying, say, defilements, the kalesa in the mind. So whatever type of defilement you see within your character, you know, you have your repertoire, you have your skillful means of basically removing them. If you've got a disposition for aversion, irritation, you know, you focus on loving kindness. If you're a very sensual person, you focus on especially anicca dukkha anatta, the body contemplation practices, four elements and death, you know, the ones which will actually cool the mind off. And then you try to bring that, you know, whatever kind of state you're working with, an underlying, say, defilement in the mind, you try to bring that state work with that state, and then bring the mind back into a state of balance, you know, back towards the center point. Yep, yep. Yeah, there are people. We had Sri Lankan monk who would not. No, he would never. He would never sleep lying down, and he could only physically, because it's quite uncomfortable, he could only sleep sitting up for maybe 2 or 3 hours a night. He couldn't go over 3 hours because physically it gets painful, you know.
Yeah, I mean, with the if I understand you correctly, you'll have to excuse me. I'm completely deaf in this right side ear, so my communications aren't so fantastic. But sitting up, sleeping.
Not sleeping posture, and if I do it another method, it must be called sleeping. I'm just thinking there has to be an intelligent way of
Yeah, well, I mean, I would, I mean, that sleeping, you know, that sleeping sitting up, I mean, we've known monks who, if you've got good meditation, you can do that type of thing, but you're better off training yourself. I mean, if you can only sleep, you know, this particular monk who could only sleep like for 3 hours in the sitting posture. My attitude is, I mean, lie down and sleep for 3 hours, because he had a bad back, and you know, so he had regular back pain, and he would use just to protect his back. He would hold a pillow on his chest and have the end of the pillow under his chin just to keep his spine aligned. But the thing was that he was, I mean, he did this through sheer willpower, and it's quite impressive actually. I mean, I wouldn't even bother doing that myself, but he was constantly drowsy. He was fighting sleep every single day, like at the breakfast and the meal. I mean, at times his nose would almost be an inch from the ground, and it was crystal clear, I mean, to me, that, you know, he really needed, he wasn't resting properly. And how can you get good meditation when you're like drowsy, I mean, right throughout the day and early evening? I just, for me, it doesn't really make sense. You know, you're better off, the person's better off training themselves. You know, you just lay out on your bed bunk or on the floor, and then you train yourself, you know, not to go past 3 hours. And I do Qigong on a regular basis, and on some days, I mean, These days I never go to. This is over the last couple of weeks. I don't like to go to sleep before 1:30 a.m. But with the Qigong, that sometimes I only sleep for maybe three and a half hours, and then I'm awake again, and I can actually get up and sit, and do things. But it's the circulation of the Qi, you know, is you. Any of the Tai Chi practitioners, they feel that their sleep cycle, the quality of the sleep increases, and absolutely no doubt the duration of the sleep decreases. Instead of before maybe 6 hours, 7 hours, realistically you can drop it. You know, if you've been doing Qigong Tai Chi for a couple of years, you can drop it down to five, no problem at all. One of the monks, his former partner was a Tai Chi teacher. She would not sleep more than 4 hours a night, you know. So, but some people, even without any kind of chi practice, they only sleep 3 hours anyway. It depends on your character, on your how much mental energy you've got. And some people just can't. Their minds are so active. They've got so much mental energy. The mind just won't stop. It's just spinning, proliferating so much. They've got to be incredibly tired just to be able to rest, to relax, and crash out. And this friend of my father's, I mean, he had to work, for him to sleep 8 hours straight, he had to work like an animal for 16 hours straight, to the point where he was physically exhausted, and his regular sleep pattern was like 3 hours, 4 hours maximum per day. And I mean, he would wake his partner up at like 3 o'clock in the morning just to talk to her, and it was a little bit hard for her to get used to. But my attitude is, yeah, I mean, go for quality. If you only want to, I've seen when I was in Thailand with the Thai monks, I saw them drop their sleep down to 3 hours a night, 4 hours a night. But you every single one of these guys, they were never alert. There was always a degree of drowsiness there, specifically because they, you know, you do that for like a couple of weeks, and that drowsiness doesn't disappear. You know they're not getting enough rest. So, you know, you see it within yourself exactly how much you need, and then you can do other things as well, just to, you know, Tai Chi or Qigong, just to make it a bit easier. But even for myself, I mean, realistically, I could do this. I could sleep 3.5 hours at night, and then I have 1 hour nap in the afternoon. I could drop it down to 4.5. Every 24, quite realistically, I could do that. So point 7, When Brahman, the bhikkhu or lay disciple is devoted to wakefulness, then the Tathagata disciplines them further. Come bhikkhu, be possessed of mindfulness and full awareness. Act in full awareness when going forward and returning. Act in full awareness when looking ahead and looking away. Act in full awareness when flexing and extending your limbs. Act in full awareness when wearing your robes and carrying your outer robe and bowl. Act in full awareness when eating, drinking, consuming food and tasting. Act in full awareness when going to the toilet and urinating. Act in full awareness when walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking and keeping silent. So it's, don't be afraid to come up with any points. So this business like full awareness means it's actually there's the two components, say sati sampajanya. The sati is you can feel what you're doing. You're actually physically aware of your physical body. So for example, you're doing carpentry, you're physically aware of your body actually working the wood, sanding the wood, using the planer, doing whatever you need to do. And the sapajanya is the wisdom component, which knows you're not only physically aware, you can feel what you're doing with your physical body, but you know why you are doing what you're doing. So it's the understanding, awareness and understanding. When they say full awareness, he's saying the big picture. You're doing an activity and you're fully with it. You know exactly what you're doing and why. Point 8. When Brahman, the bhikkhu, possesses mindfulness and full awareness, then the Tathagata disciplines them further. Come bhikkhu, resort to a secluded resting place, the forest, the root of a tree, a mountain, a ravine, hillside cave, a charnel ground, jungle thicket, an open heap of straw. They resort to a secluded resting place, the forest, the heap of straw. On returning from their arms round after the meal, he or she sits down, folding their legs crosswise, setting the body erect, and establishing mindfulness before them. Abandoning covetousness, possessiveness and greed for the world, they abide with a mind free from covetousness. They purify their mind from covetousness. Abandoning ill will and hatred, they abide with a mind free from ill will, compassionate for the welfare of all living beings. They purify their mind from ill will and hatred. Abandoning sloth and torpor, they abide free from sloth and torpor, percipient of light. Mindful and fully aware, he purifies his mind from sloth and torpor. Abandoning restlessness and remorse, he abides unagitated with a mind inwardly peaceful. He purifies his mind from restlessness and remorse. Abandoning doubt, they abide, having gone beyond doubt, unperplexed about wholesome states, the understanding of wholesome states. They purify their mind from doubt. So, you know, this business with the five hindrances, which are the five obstructions to samatha practice, but this principle of they purify their mind from sloth and torpor. We had a monk with us from England who practiced the white casino when he was, I think he was in Sri Lanka for a couple of years, and because of the energy that he was able to generate with the white casino, the visualization of that particular device, that the mental energy was that high that he was another one who only needed to sleep 4 hours every 24, even with the tropical humidity climate. So point, yes? Yep, yep. It's more like it depends on your
your temperament. Some people, they could do it. You need a minimum level of, I'd say, yeah, minimum level of, say, medium range meditation, not beginner stuff, in order to basically hack it, because you've got to, you know, it's not only it's the loneliness, you've got predators, wild animals, bears, you've been eaten alive by mosquitoes, you've got leeches crawling everywhere, parasites, you get sick on an irregular basis, you know, things are hard to come by, and it's physically reasonably tough, you know, you're having to deal with the heat and the humidity and whatnot. And so the person's got, say, reasonably strong meditation, they've got the resolve, but you've still got to be careful as well, where one of our monks was in seclusion in Sri Lanka, and he basically thought he had attained to Dhamma. And this is not a silly person. He was quite a smart fellow, and he was living alone. Oh, he's been living alone for quite some time. And but you've got to be quite careful, because you can lose it. You know, some people, if you're practicing that hard, you'd like 10, 12, 14 hours a day. If you haven't got yourself together, if your mind isn't firm, and you know, and if there's any weaknesses in your personality, or the defilements, basically, because you're pushing the practice that hard, they take over the mind. You can start thinking all sorts of strange things. Some people, they go to the forest and they lose their minds. So you've got, for me, I would never, even if I had good meditation, I would be inclined to, say, go with a friend but live apart. Live at least a couple of hundred metres apart. If anything goes wrong, or somebody just flips out, or they get sick, or they get attacked by an animal, at least they've got someone to back them up. But it's not the average person, basically. They'd really have difficulty. You can give it. You can try it for intervals of time. You could try it for maybe, say, like, to get a real feel for it, 4 weeks at a stretch, and then. But if the quality of the practice deteriorates, if their mind is really disturbed and there's all sorts of problems coming up, they'd probably be better off in a community setting, where they're mixing with other people, and maybe they just wind the practice down a bit. Because when you're in the forest, I mean, what else are you going to do? You may have a couple of books. You can chant, maybe chant sutras, but you've got hours and hours on end, and it's either you meditate, you've got your meditation, which is your main thing, you're chanting, maybe chanting sutras or reflecting. But people can end up sleeping if they can't get the practice together. They just get very dozy, and they kill time. There's no one around. You can sleep 8-10 hours a day if you want to. So, but when you're in a community setting, you've got regular meetings, you've got people around, they're around you all the time. They can see where your practice is at, they can see where your mind is at. People run into problems or difficulties, or things go wrong, or they can easily connect with their teacher and this kind of thing. So it's much more supportive. Yep, yep. Yeah. So he was using the white casino for, I think, I'd say absolute minimum 6 months or so, in that last 6 months, because he had like 2 years in Sri Lanka. He was doing Anapanasati, and he was just kept falling asleep all the time, just the humidity in the area where he was staying. And and then he started visualizing the white disc casino in his mind's eye, and he was a very, very visual person.
He used to be an artist, and he found that quite useful. You know, so you're maximizing. I mean, you know, you're looking at levels of energy, but he was able to sort of max out the mental energy in relation with the meditation that he had. He'd taken it to like a high point. So point 10. Having thus abandoned these five hindrances, imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, they enter upon and abide in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought or attention with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. With the stilling of applied and sustained thought, they enter upon and abide in the second jhana, which has self-confidence. It's a funny rendering, self-confidence. A singleness of mind without applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of concentration or stillness. Concentration doesn't imply force. Samadhi is stillness is the correct interpretation for samadhi, the samadhi experience. With the fading away as well of rapture, they abide in equanimity and mindful and fully aware. This business here, fully aware inside the mind, not outside the mind, not outside the body. You know, the attention is very, very deep inside the mind, and all that person knows is that pure state of mind, consciousness, still feeling pleasure with the body, which is not correct. They enter upon abide in the third jhana, which Acharya Brahm said is the happiness, has the greatest, highest level of emotional happiness that you feel when you actually come out of that state. You know, it's like you're over the moon. Abide in the third jhana, on account of which the noble ones announce they have a pleasant abiding who has equanimity and is mindful. There's not equanimity. It's the Piti Sukha is at its peak in the third jhana, and the equanimity, that Piti Sukha hasn't been refined to the point where you can call it equanimity. With the abandoning of pleasure and pain and with the previous disappearance of joy and grief, they enter upon abide in the fourth jhana, which has neither pleasure nor neither pain nor pleasure, and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. This is my instruction, Brahman, to those bhikkhus who are in the higher training, whose minds have not yet attained the goal, who abide aspiring to the supreme security from bondage, that these things conduce both to a pleasant abiding here and now and to mindfulness and full awareness for those, say, bhikkhus or the arahant lay disciples are much more difficult to come by. Even within the monastic fraternity, there may only be, I'll say like figures, if I looked at maybe Thailand, you could look at maybe possibly 1 in 100 practitioners has attained to Dhamma, maybe maximum. That'd be absolute maximum. Maximum, I think. Maybe even less than that, maybe. Or, you know, say for example, you've got, I think Burma's the same in the Rains Retreat. You may have like 500, say, monastics easily, both on the male-female side, in the middle of the rains. Who abide aspiring to the supreme security and bondage, but these things are conducive to both the pleasant abiding here and now and to mindfulness and full awareness for those because who are arahants with taints destroyed, who have lived the holy life, done what is to be done, laid down the burden of rebirth process, reached the true goal of a human being, destroyed the fetters of being, the 10 fetters, and are completely liberated through final knowledge or insight. Point 11. When this was said, the Brahmin Ganaka Moggallana asked the Blessed One, when Master Gotama's disciples are thus advised. Yeah, this, let me see now. Yeah, this business, just get me, you know, before I miss this point, point 11, you know, where both the monks and the bhikkhunis with the, when they're become seminaries or novice monks, they make that declaration that they live the holy life for the attainment of Nibbana. And naturally, in the West, that may be largely the case, but that's not necessarily the case in Asia, where people become monks and nuns for, you know, they like for social service. They become religious social workers, counselors, they become scholars. It depends on their personal characteristics and their disposition, which direction they may wish to go in community life. Because especially as a monastic, there's just so many avenues open to you if you want to get into education, into helping people. There's you know, all sorts of things. There's hospitals, there's prisons, there's death, you know, people death and dying. There's youth, you know, there's troubled youth, and there's all sorts of things you can do. So, but you know that, but you find that within the usually within, you know, so you know naturally, and you get the short term, what do they call it, short term ordinations, where people make the declaration, but they only ordain for like a week. 2 weeks and they go back home. But the thing is, it's much better than doing nothing at all, and they get the benefit of it. They really put their heart into it. Even the Thai monks I've seen have only just ordained for 7 days, they still get the benefit. And when you see them come back later, you do see a small change in their character. Point 12. When this was said, the Brahmin Ganaka Moggallana asked the Blessed One, when Master Gotama's disciples are thus advised and instructed by him, do they all attain Nibbana, the ultimate goal, or do some not attain it? Is my voice loud enough? Is it loud enough? When Brahmin, they are thus advised and instructed by me, some of my disciples attain Nibbana, the ultimate goal, and some do not attain it. Point 13. Master Gotama, since Nibbana exists and the path leading to Nibbana exists, and Master Gotama is present as the guide, what is the cause and reason why, when Master Gotama's disciples are thus advised and instructed by him, some of them attain Nibbana, the ultimate goal, and some do not attain it? This has come up in the past where we've had, like, say, good monks in the forest tradition, good practice monks with, say, absolute minimum 20, 25, 30 reins who basically have very good sila. They're training themselves to the best of their ability. Most of them are in abbots in management positions, which is a bit tricky. But, you know, you'll have some who may live quite quietly, but they still don't develop very deep meditation, and especially on the samadhi side, it's a very, very crucial point. If you're a monk or a nun, and you've got good samadhi, it's virtually, I mean, you know, if you get the samadhi nimitta every couple of days, I mean, I can't see that person disrobing. You know, they'll essentially die in the robes unless something goes wrong. And they lose that meditation completely. But just having that entry point to Upachara Samadhi with the Samadhi Nimitta, it makes you aware of what you get an understanding of what the mind is. You know, what real happiness is, the energy which arises in that experience, and the insights which will come up for reflection after you withdraw to a normal state
of consciousness. So, you know, even at that level, I couldn't see that person actually leaving the monastery. They're onto a good thing. They've got an understanding. The experience has gone deep enough. They've got an understanding, which helps keep them in robes in community life. But where things go wrong, is basically those individuals. No disrespect to any of them who have disrobed in the past. But basically, their defilements get the jump on them, and they take possession of the mind, and then they take the person out of robes in many, many different ways. But you usually find the classic examples are like boredom, loss of interest, dissatisfaction, sensuality, especially male female energy. This one's just a classic with the monks, because they tend to be much more physical than the nuns. And even one of the sisters, when I was at Santi, we were discussing this point, and she said she's never known any nun who's actually disrobed from just sheer lust alone. You know, she fell in love with a bloke. And that was the main exit point. You know, physical lust wasn't enough to take any of the people out, the females that she knew. It's more of a, like, it's an emotional, with the females, more of an emotional mindset. Point. Just finishing off that point where those people have been practicing for 30 years, they still don't get the meditation hasn't gone deep enough. They don't get very good results. You know, the standard is definitely good enough, and they've been doing it for quite some time. But it's that key point, especially the samadhi. Even if the wisdom is not strong, and the seal is not perfect, just having that level of samadhi will keep you in robes till the day. You know, samadhi nimitta, upachara samadhi will keep you in robes till the day you die, because of that happiness, incredible happiness that you keep touching on again and again and again. And point 14. As to that Brahman, I will ask you a question in return. Answer as you choose. What do you think, Brahman? Are you familiar with the road leading to Rajagaha? Yes, Master Gotama, I am familiar with the road leading to Rajagaha. What do you think, Brahman? Suppose a man came who wanted to go to Rajagaha, and he approached you and said, Venerable Sir, I want to go to Rajagaha. Show me the road to Rajagaha. Then you told him, Now, good man, this road goes to Rajagaha. Follow it for a while and you will see a certain village. Go a little further and you will see a certain town. Go a little further and you will see Rajagaha, with its lovely parks, groves, meadows and ponds. Then, having been thus advised and instructed by you, he would take a wrong road and would go to the west. And then a second man came who wanted to go to Rajagaha, and he approached you and said, Venerable Sir, I want to go to Rajagaha. And then you told him, Now, good man, this road goes to Rajagaha. Follow it for a while and you will see Rajagaha, with its lovely parks, groves, meadows and ponds. Then, having been thus advised and instructed by you, he would arrive safely in Rajagaha. Now, Brahman, since Rajagaha exists and the path leading to Rajagaha exists, and you are present as the guide, what is the cause and reason why, when those people have thus been advised and instructed by you, one person takes a wrong road and goes to the west, and one arrives safely in Rajagaha? So this business, you know, say for example you're in the monastery, you are under a top-ranked teacher, you do everything that teacher tells you, and you're developing yourself to quite you're following the path correctly. You may not necessarily have fantastic results, but a point that which comes up, especially with the monastics, is they have to protect their mind from their own defilements, because, you know, that is the, just repeating myself, that is the thing which will take you out in almost every single case. You can be incredibly sick, where you become, say, almost like a burden on the community, but the vast majority of people, of monks and nuns, they would rather nurse you than have you disrobe, because especially people who are committed. I mean, I would rather nurse somebody every day for years than have that person disrobe, you know, because they're making so much progress, you know, even if they just do a little bit of meditation, but they're keeping the sila, they're doing a bit of study if they can, they're developing their foundation principles, and if they go back to lay life as quite a sickly person, they're compromised to quite a major degree. So you've got the kind of supportive environment there. So this whole point, you know, just keeping the mind in balance, you know, you look very closely to what, you know, exactly which way the defilements manifest in the mind, because they're, you know, very, very tricky, very resourceful defilements. They have a mind of their own. They twist and turn. It's like, what's the right words? You know, they can take thousands and thousands of different forms. They can swap and change according to different circumstances and situations. So within yourself, if you, you know, as a practitioner, as a lay practitioner, as a monastic, you've got to watch this one very, very closely, and never ever think, even if you've got 20, 30 years as a lay practitioner or even as a monastic, that you are in full control of your mind. You know exactly what you are doing at any time with any person. It's not true. The mind can just turn just like that so easily. What can I do about that, Master Gotama? I am one who shows the way. So too, Brahman, Nibbana exists and the path leading to Nibbana exists. And I am present as the guide. Yet when my disciples have been thus advised and instructed by me, some of them attain Nibbana, the ultimate goal, and some do not attain it. What can I do about that, Brahman? The Tathagata is one who shows the way. When this was said, the Brahman Ganaka Moggallana said to the Blessed One, There are persons who are faithless and gone forth from the home life into homelessness, not out of faith, but seeking a livelihood, which is much more difficult in the West. Who are fraudulent, deceitful, treacherous, haughty, hollow, personally vain, rough-tongued, loose-spoken, unguarded in their sense faculties, immoderate in eating, undevoted to wakefulness, unconcerned with recluseship, not greatly respectful of training, luxurious, careless, leaders in backsliding, neglectful of seclusion, lazy, wanting in energy, unmindful, not fully aware, unconcentrated, with straying minds, devoid of wisdom, drivellers. Master Gotama does not dwell together with these or these people, but there are clansmen who have gone forth out of faith from the home life into homelessness, who are not fraudulent, deceitful, treacherous, haughty, hollow, personally vain, rough-tongued and loose-spoken, who are guarded in their sense faculties, moderate in eating, devoted to wakefulness, concerned with recluseship, greatly respectful of training, not luxurious or careless, who are keen to avoid backsliding, leaders in seclusion, energetic, resolute, established in mindfulness, fully aware, concentrated, with unified minds in samadhi, or jhana, possessing wisdom, the wisdom which arises from that jhana, not drivellers. Master Gotama dwells together with these, so associating with like-minded people who are intent on the attainment of the goal. Just as black orris root is reckoned as the best of root perfumes, and red sandalwood is reckoned as the best of wood perfumes, and jasmine is reckoned as the best of flower perfumes, so too Master Gotama's advice is supreme among the teachings of today. Magnificent Master Gotama, Master Gotama has made the Dhamma clear in many ways, as though he was turning upright what has been overturned, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who was lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see form.
I go to Master Gotama for refuge and to the Dhamma and to the Sangha of Bhikkhus. Let Master Gotama remember me as a lay disciple who has gone forth to him for refuge for life. So that's, you know, it's pretty amazing, go to refuge for life. But, you know, I mean, the Buddha was such an incredible teacher. I mean, some people could certainly do that. But, you know, maybe in the West that might be a lot, maybe not so breezy. But you find that, you know, even with the I mean, like years ago, just mentioning the same story, we had a Christian, one of the young monks cut a couple of reins. He went over to the Christians, but the Ajahn Jagrao understood that he, you know, in reality, he had a mix of both Buddhist and Christian karma. And he just woke up one day and he felt that Jesus was calling him. But I got the impression he was in the monastery like absolute minimum, like 3 years, 4 years, I don't know exactly. And then just to wake up one day and then feel that Jesus is calling you and you want to go over to the Christian fraternity, which I don't think is a bad thing, but for that to actually come up in a person's mind, excuse me, I mean, after studying, you know, actually practicing Buddhism in the community life for that period of time, I sort of look at that like that kind of that mind state as a sort of state of delusion. I don't know how mentally well that person was together, but you just imagine, you know, you've been reflecting yourself, you've been studying Dhamma 3-4 years, and then just suddenly one day you change your mind and go over to the Christian fraternity. It's a pretty amazing thing to do. But he stayed with the Christian monks at New Norcia for a couple of years, but he had very little personal time, very little time for meditation, and in the end he disrobed. I mean, they expect these guys to take life vows, but if you want to leave, I mean, they can't stop you. No. So did anybody have any views, opinions? Yeah, because I mean, yeah, with the, especially with it.
Unless, I guess, if you add on the top, which is going to uplift you and bring the whole sermon, it's not, I think, if the top is leading you to something silly.
Yeah, well, it's really our feelings which are calling the shots. It's not our thoughts. Pure thought in itself is nothing without emotion. So it's our feelings which emotions our lead us in different ways, you know, in life, which basically control our direction. But you know, if we have a level of you know, you develop wisdom in daily life, you develop skillfulness, understanding. And, you know, you don't have to be a perfect human being, but, you know, you just do the best with what you've got, and you pace yourself. You know, the kind of practice that you have now, the Dhamma practice that you have at this point in your life, I mean, can you sustain that, I mean, without difficulty for the next 12 months, you know? Just, I mean, if you can say that straight off the cuff, it means you're in a comfortable range, and that's the... And it's a key, it's an important principle, because there's no point knocking yourself out and pushing yourself beyond the limits, you know, doing maybe excessive meditation, being overly strict with oneself, trying to, you know, like live on one main meal a day when you're, you know, say for example, if you're like doing engineering and you're doing a lot of physical work, you're working with a sledgehammer and you're doing 3 shifts, like afternoon shift and night shift. And most people, you know, most blokes just couldn't keep it up, you know, unless you've got this very, very stable energy reserves. And that, you know, the ability to sustain this practice we do, that's far more important than being, you know, being like a superman or superwoman and then just going hell for leather, you know, trying to get it together as quick as possible. It's much better to, you know, just take it nice and easy, and you're still there consistently, like in 20, 30, 40 years' time, and your practice is very well-rounded, it's very solid, it's firm, you know what you're doing, you know how to work with your mind, you know, you've got, all your supporting factors are there, you can see them clearly, and you don't stop. You know, you just keep going, and you keep going, you know, in consideration, if your faculties are clear, you keep going until the day you die, and then you just pick up next life. You know, the vast majority of people are either born, especially when they've got solid Dharma practice, the vast majority of those people do not fall below the human realm. They're reborn in either human realm or Devaloka, and you make the determination very before you die, that if you are reborn either as in Devaloka or as a human being, that you reaffirm your commitment to the Buddhist path and you keep the practice going. You know, you don't allow time to, you don't waste time, you don't allow, you know, like in enjoying myself in Devaloka and just losing tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of years, you know, when realistically, you can practice, and it is possible. You can develop your mind in the Deva realms, but you've got to establish that intention. I mean, very early. Otherwise, people just completely lose it in those worlds. So, which point? 15. Yeah, well, you know, I mean, you can choose, you know, you can choose your, it's like, you know, you can choose, say, for example, if you're a monastic or lay disciple, you can choose the monastery that you want to go to and practice Dhamma. You know, you can choose the people you associate with to a degree. Because, you know, if you mix with the wrong people, they can just take you down the garden path, you know, they lead you in all sorts of directions. But, this business about, so for example, you've got somebody in a community, they if they're keeping a good standard, they can't be forcibly removed, say, even by the abbot, with the like Sangha regulations, with the Vinaya. It's got to be, you're looking at a community decision. Maybe in Thailand or Burma, the abbot's got quite a reasonable degree of power. But in the West, we don't do it like that. If you've got, for example, even the abbot could maybe dislike, maybe a junior monk. You know, there's some major problem there. But if the junior monk's behaving himself, well, it's the abbot's problem. You know, no one, even in any community, you just can't expect perfection with people. Everyone, people are different. They're going to rub you up the wrong way. They're going to say things you may not like, and they won't necessarily meet your expectations, but you've just got to learn to mix them. As long as they keep a minimum standard. Yeah, but you usually find for... like in the West, it's maybe a little bit more tricky because you've got unlimited number of monasteries, but the bottom line, if they follow the guidelines that the Buddha laid down as far as Dhamma and Vinaya, it doesn't matter what kind of personality they have, because you usually find very few problems come up between individuals in community life. But once they start breaking Vinaya in a major way, or they start, you know, like preaching wrong views, and they've got all sorts of funny ideas, that's when trouble starts to come up. But you know, if major problems come up, you have a community meeting, everyone's there. Or say the person who's creating problems. Say for example, you've got a person who's creating major problems. You have a community meeting. You discuss it, and then the community decides what kind of approach we take with that person. Usually, you give them a couple of chances, and if they're not prepared to play ball and do the right thing, well, maybe it's time that they go somewhere else. You know, you don't have to like throw them out, or it's a community decision. The abbot or the senior monks, they talk it over with the person, and they say, you know, we feel that you're not prepared to basically fit in with the community here, or live harmoniously with other people. It might be better if you move on. You know, you can support that person, you can give them a ticket to the next destination, or if they feel they may be happier with another teacher or another group of monks, it could be even in another country, it's worth supporting them and sending them to their next destination, because some people they may not want to live in specific communities. We're lucky in the West, we don't have any of the monasteries that I know in the West, the community members there, they're quite reasonable people. They're decent people. You know, I can't think of any community in the West where there's just like you've got so many rat bags that you just wouldn't be prepared to go there, you know. Yeah, it's like the Buddha lays the guidelines down for training, and if the disciples, if they're interested, if they're keen, if they're motivated, they follow the Buddha's advice. So it's just common sense stuff. You know, we all of us have faith. We have a minimum level of faith in the Buddha. As the supreme teacher within this particular system of, I wouldn't call it not religious, but in the system of, say, spiritual training. And, if you have, it's just that classic line, you test it for yourself, you practice the Dhamma, and, you see if it actually works for you, if it gets good results, if it leads to happiness, to wisdom, and whatnot, you test it for yourself. But because the Dhamma is grounded in reality principles, it's not some kind of airy fairy type of doctrine, highfalutin philosophical doctrine. It's based in reality principles that you can prove for yourself. So you develop this path to the best of your ability, and you see, you put in the right causes with the path, and you see the results, the good results, over time. Thank you, Doug. Okay, we'll finish it there.